Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 280. It's Monday, November 4th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, folks, well, let's start off with a gun violence story. This from the Washington Post. U.S. gun deaths in some states are similar to conflict zones. The rate of firearm deaths in several U.S. states is similar to their frequency in places around the world that are battling civil unrest or bloody gang wars, a new report shows. The report, published by the Commonwealth Fund, an independent research group, found that the overall rate of firearm deaths in Mississippi was nearly twice that of Haiti, an impoverished Caribbean nation where violent gangs control large swaths of the country and whose president was assassinated by gunmen in 2021. Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama also had higher firearm deaths than Mexico, where rival drug cartels are engaged in bloody conflict. Montana's death rate from guns was higher than in Colombia, where drug trafficking is rife. Wyoming, Arizona, and Oklahoma all ranked above Brazil. Suburban New Jersey had a higher gun death rate than Nicaragua, Mali, and Djibouti. In June, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy declared gun violence a public health crisis, putting it on par with the 1960s warning on the lethal consequences of cigarette smoking. The latest report illustrates just how bad gun violence has gotten in the U.S. and how it is something we should be talking about far more than we do, said Evan Gumas, a research associate at the Commonwealth Fund and a co-author of the report. The fact that the U.S. ranks among countries that are involved in some form of conflict, whether it be civil war, general unrest, drug arms, trafficking, etc., is really startling, and even more so when we look at where U.S. states compare on the global scale. I do think many Americans would be surprised by how similar our rates are to those in the world's conflict zones. Researchers defined firearm mortality in the study as an aggregate of physical violence by firearm, self-harm by firearm, and unintentional firearm injuries. Globally, the United States ranks in the 93rd percentile for overall firearm mortality, the 92nd percentile for firearm mortality among children and teenagers, and the 96th percentile in firearm mortality among women, the report found. And next up, honing into a specific context of the U.S. gun violence situation or violent situation, this from Axios. Hospitals and clinics among Americans' most violent workplaces. Hospitals and clinics remain among the most violent workplaces in America, continuing to strain health workers in the aftermath of the pandemic experience. The situation is bad enough that the American Hospital Association and the FBI last week announced that they're collaborating on resources to help hospitals make threat assessments and work to mitigate risks. Verbal threats and physical assaults against doctors, nurses, and other health workers typically come from patients' family or friends, or even from patients themselves. Even as violent crime ticks down in large U.S. cities, violence in healthcare settings continues due to long wait times, unmet patient needs, and resource shortages in the sector, according to a recent review in the journal eClinical Medicine. Healthcare and social services account for 73% of the almost 58,000 non-fatal workplace violence incidents requiring employees to miss work in 2021 and 2022, per the most recent data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Federal data shows that 14 cases of workplace violence in the healthcare sector in each year for every 10,000 full-time workers. Private industry overall had 2.9 cases per 10,000 workers. So that's over a quadruple higher rate than the average for workplaces in healthcare settings. COVID-19 worsened the issue. The pandemic and the fierce debate over the response helped sow distrust in the health system, with workers' reports of harassment on the job more than doubling in 2022 compared with before the pandemic, says CDC data. But the problem hasn't abated since, and workplace violence in healthcare settings has been increasing steadily before then, too, rising 62% from 2011 to 2018. The actual rate of violence is likely much higher than statistics indicate, because federal data primarily captures incidents that lead to time away from work or job transfers, and not every facility has agreed on standards for reporting incidents either. The uptick in physical violence coincides with a major increase in cybersecurity breaches in the healthcare sector, placing extra stress on health system security. Federal regulators are slated to propose new standards to prevent workplace violence in healthcare settings in December, following a review that began in 2016.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, let's move on to a couple infectious disease stories. This from Reuters. U.S. to begin bulk milk testing for bird flu after push from industry. The U.S. Department of Agriculture will soon begin testing bulk raw milk across the country for bird flu, a significant expansion of the agency's efforts to stifle the rapid spread of the virus, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told Reuters. The move comes after livestock and veterinary groups pushed the USDA to strengthen its current surveillance approach, calling it inadequate to contain the virus, according to state records and industry documents reviewed by Reuters. The agency in early November will begin sampling milk in states where dairy cattle have contracted bird flu, known to contract, including testing specified farms as needed to track the virus's spread. USD will then begin testing in states who have not identified the virus in dairy cows, he said. Virologists and federal health officials are also concerned the convergence of bird flu and seasonal influenza could enable the bird flu virus to mutate if people become co-infected, making it more easily transmissible among humans. The USDA had previously said eliminating bird flu in the nation's dairy cattle was possible using its prior approach. Dairy farmers in some states have resisted voluntary testing of their animals for fear of economic repercussions. We can't wait for a virus to burn out. That strategy has not worked, said Keith Polson, director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, who has been involved in discussions about the new recommendations. Just 50 of the nation's 27,000 dairy herds were enrolled in USDA's voluntary herd testing program, and that nearly 18 million commercial poultry birds have been killed after flocks tested positive for the bovine, that's the cow variant, of bird flu, suggesting that dairy farms are fueling the virus's spread to poultry. So this is the way it works. Even though it's called avian or bird flu, that's just where it was originally predominant. But now it's in over 50 mammal species, including cows. And now that cows are a reservoir for that infection, cows are actually infecting poultry again. So it's going back and forth between these different populations. And of course, economically, farmers are getting more and more worried as you're killing millions and millions of poultry birds due to bird flu infections. But this story does represent a little bit of shift in the interest, as while individual farmers are still fearful of the economic consequences, groups of farmers and agriculture groups are starting to recognize that they need to deal with this together and can't just hold out waiting for it to disappear. Okay, well, next up, let's turn to the number one infectious disease killer in the world. This from Medical Express. Tuberculosis infected 8 million people last year, the most the WHO has ever tracked. More than 8 million people were diagnosed with tuberculosis last year, the World Health Organization said, the highest number recorded since the UN Health Agency began keeping track. About 1.25 million people died of TB last year, the new report said, adding that TB likely returned to being the world's top infectious disease killer after being replaced by COVID-19 during the pandemic. The deaths are almost double the number of people killed by HIV in 2023. WHO said TB continues to mostly affect people in Southeast Asia, Africa, and the Western Pacific. India, Indonesia, China, the Philippines, and Pakistan account for more than half of the world's cases. The fact that TB still kills and sickens so many people is an outrage when we have the tools to prevent it, detect it, and treat it, said the WHO Director General. TB deaths continue to fall globally, however, and the number of people being newly infected is beginning to stabilize. The agency noted that of the 400,000 people estimated to have drug-resistant TB last year, fewer than half were diagnosed and treated. Tuberculosis is caused by airborne bacteria that mostly affect the lungs. Roughly a quarter of the global population is estimated to have TB, but only about 5 to 10% of those go on to develop symptoms. Advocacy groups, including Doctors Without Borders, have long called for the U.S. company Cepheid, which produces TB tests used in poorer countries, to make them available for $5 per test to increase availability. Earlier this month, Doctors Without Borders and 150 global health partners sent the pharmaceutical company an open letter calling on them to prioritize people's lives and to urgently help make TB testing more widespread globally. So TB is an ancient disease that still ravages the world today. Okay, well, let's turn to a newer problem brought about by modernity. This from the Environmental Health Network. Ultra-processed foods and plastic packaging make for the ultimate toxic pair, scientists say. Plastic packaging is critical to the business model of ultra-processed foods, with ultra-processed foods producers like Coca-Cola and Nestle among the leading plastic polluters worldwide. The properties of ultra-processed foods, like acidity, high fat content, and long storage times, increases the migration of plastic chemicals into food. Ultra-processed foods also contain more microplastic contamination than minimally processed foods due to the plastic used in their manufacturing and packaging. Consumers do not have the power to solve a problem at this scale, and thus it is the responsibility of policymakers to ensure that transitions away from unhealthy, unsustainable foods are accompanied by structural measures that support demand and access to healthy foods. Over a third of the plastics produced globally are used for packaging, with about 83% of flexible food packaging made from plastic. Ultra-processed foods, which rely on plastics for their portioning and long shelf lives, have been consistently linked to negative health outcomes like cancer, respiratory, cardiovascular, and metabolic diseases, and even premature mortality. The authors of this paper emphasize the need for strong action from regulators to hold ultra-processed food producers accountable for the harm they cause. And while plastics is an emerging health threat that we're learning more and more about all the time, we're still learning more about older threats, this one about lead, this from Medical Express. Low-level lead poisoning accounts for cognitive deficits in children, risk factors for heart conditions. Chronic low-level lead poisoning is a major risk factor for cardiovascular disease in adults and cognitive deficits in children, even at levels previously thought to be safe, according to a paper by Columbia University School of Public Health, Simon Fraser University in Canada, Harvard Medical School, and Boston Children's Hospital. Low-level lead poisoning is a risk factor for preterm birth, cognitive deficits, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, as well as increased blood pressure and reduced heart rate variability. The findings are published in the New England Journal of Medicine. In children, exposure is responsible for an annual loss of some 765 million IQ points in children globally. Low-level lead poisoning is a risk factor for adults, which can result in chronic kidney failure, hypertension, and cardiovascular disease. Lead accounted for 5.5 million deaths annually from cardiovascular disease. The global burden of disease from lead exposure is staggering, said Anna Navasasian, a professor and chair of environmental health sciences at Columbia School of Public Health. In contrast to the decline in the rate of coronary heart disease in industrialized countries, the rate has increased over the past 30 years in industrializing countries. 1 in 3 children worldwide, more than 600 million children, have lead poisoning. Lead is readily absorbed by rapidly growing infants. In adults, 95% of retained lead is stored in the skeleton. Factors such as menopause and hyperthyroidism release lead sequestered in the skeleton, which causes a spike in blood level concentrations. The steep decrease in IQ and the sharp increase in the risk of death from cardiovascular disease, even at the lowest measurable blood level concentrations, coupled with pervasive exposure, indicate that population strategies are critical for eliminating lead poisoning, said Bruce Lanfear of Simon Fraser University. While lead exposure has declined by nearly 100% since 1970 and is no longer used in the U.S. and Europe, physicians assume that lead poisoning is a problem of the past. Yet exposures linger from lead paint in older houses, leaded gasoline in soil, seeping lead from water lines, and emissions from industrial plants and incinerators. Some people are at increased risk for lead poisoning as compared with the general population. The mouthing behaviors of toddlers puts them at great risk for lead ingestion, and toddlers who live in poorly maintained housing built before 1960 are at risk of lead poisoning from ingestion of paint chips and dust. Also endangered are people who drink tap water from lead service lines or live near airports or other sites that emit lead pollution. In the United States, airborne lead concentrations are markedly higher in racially segregated communities than in integrated communities. The amount of lead in blood considered to signify potential harm has been revised downward several times. In children, it went from 100 micrograms per liter to 50 in 2012 to 35 in 2021. Yet no safe level of lead in children's blood has been identified, noted David Bellinger of Harvard Medical School. Surveillance and targeted screening are important, but the solution to protecting people from lead poisoning is to identify and eliminate environmental sources of lead wherever they are found. This means eliminating lead-acid batteries, replacing lead service lines, banning leaded aviation fuel, reducing lead in foods, abating lead paint in older housing, and further reducing lead-contaminated soil and other legacy sources. Plenty still to do. Okay, next up, news on the climate crisis. This from The Hill. Fossil fuel subsidies fueling global health crisis. World governments are fueling the fire of global health crises, with the trillions of dollars per year they direct towards subsidizing fossil fuels. Research in The Lancet, one of the world's leading medical journals, found that residents of every country on Earth are facing the unnatural and unprecedented effects of a crisis that governments of wealthy nations are actively funding. This year's stock take of the imminent health threats of climate inaction reveals the most concerning findings yet in our 8 years of monitoring, warned Marina Romanella, executive director of Lancet Countdown, which for nearly a decade has tracked the globe's progress on health and climate change. The Lancet has long portrayed climate change as a leading threat to global public health, and Romanello said that the past year only reinforced that relationship. Once again, last year broke climate change records, with extreme heat waves, deadly weather events, and devastating wildfires affecting people around the world. No individual or economy on the planet is immune from the health threats of climate change. Even as the threat looms, Romanella added, we see financial resources continue to be invested in the very things that undermine our health. The year 2023 was the hottest on record. In practical terms, that meant that across the globe, the average person experienced 50 additional days or nearly 2 months of dangerous temperatures that would not have happened without decades of burning fossil fuels, the researchers found. The rising heat also correlated with extreme drought, afflicting almost half of the global land area in 2023, which correlated in turn to an additional 151 million people experiencing some form of food insecurity. The heat also correlated with 512 billion hours of lost labor, a cost of nearly $1 trillion in gross domestic product that was borne disproportionately by the poorest countries. Because hot air is thirstier, and therefore wetter, the rising heat has correlated with a rise in floods as well. Flood risks have increased over the last decade across two-thirds of the Earth's surface, a rise seen recently dramatically in the unexpected lethal flooding that Hurricane Helene brought to the mountain communities of the southeastern U.S. Amid a rising crisis, one that is outstripping the ability of all governments, but particularly lower-income ones, to adapt, the wealthy world is pursuing policies that are making things worse, the Lancet writers noted. The relentless expansion of fossil fuels and record-breaking greenhouse gas emission compounds these dangerous health impacts, Romanello said. Such a build-out is threatening to reverse the limited progress made so far and put a healthy future further out of reach. While investment in renewable energy is increasing, helping double the generation of clean electricity between 2016 and 2023, the Lancet study found the investments in new fossil fuels still made up more than two-thirds of new energy spending in 2023, and 84% of world governments still subsidize their use, in effect paying an estimated $1.4 trillion per year to worsen the crisis. Such support, in tandem with the high oil sector profits that followed Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine that helped the world's 114 biggest oil and gas companies to push their production to record levels in 2023, a production volume that the Lancet study found puts the maintenance of a safe climate out of reach. The Lancet authors called for redirecting the money governments are now using to subsidize fossil fuels towards public health initiatives, which Romanello said would provide the opportunity to deliver a fair, equitable transition to clean energy and energy efficiency, and a healthier future, ultimately benefiting the global economy. Researchers pointed some signs that indicate progress is possible, like the rise in clean energy generation and the record employment in the renewable sector, as well as the hundreds of thousands of lives saved as reductions in coal burning have led to cleaner and less toxic air. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres offered a scathing response to the findings and called on world governments to cure the sickness of climate inaction, in particular by slashing emissions, protecting people from climate extremes, and ending our fossil fuel addiction.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted. Or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
And of course, air pollution is something that happens with fossil fuel burning. So here's a little bit of a delineation on one of those problems. This is from Science Daily: asthma and fine particulate matter. Drawing on evidence involving about 25 million people worldwide, an international research team demonstrated that long-term exposure to ambient PM2.5, which is air pollutant, those particles less than 2.5 microns, significantly increases the risk of asthma, affecting both children and adults. The researchers find that approximately 30% of new asthma cases worldwide are linked to fine particulate matter exposure, highlighting the dramatic threat air pollution poses to public health. Personally, I gotta wonder if I'd have asthma if I didn't live in the state with the worst air quality in the nation. Okay, well, next up, a less obvious effect of air pollution. This from MedPage Today. Converging evidence of link between air pollution and breast cancer. Long-term exposure to air pollution may increase women's risk of breast cancer, a large cohort study suggests. Breast cancer risk increased incrementally by 28% with increasing exposure to fine particulate matter, that PM2.5. The association was similar across racial ethnic groups and irrespective of hormone receptor status. A meta-analysis of this and 10 other prospective cohorts showed a trend towards increased breast cancer risk with greater PM2.5 exposure. As about half of breast cancer risk cannot be explained by established breast cancer risk factors, and incidence is continuing to increase, particularly in low and middle-income countries. Our results highlight that breast cancer prevention should include not only individual-level behavior-centered approaches, but also population-wide policies and regulations to curb PM2.5 pollution, concluded Anna Wu of the School of the UCLA School of Medicine and co-authors published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. The consistency of analysis and the accompanying meta-analysis suggests that the epidemiologic literature is converging on PM2.5 as a risk factor for breast cancer. These findings support additional policy-level interventions to reduce outdoor air pollution concentrations, particularly given the projected increases in PM2.5 because of wildfires, stated Alexandra White of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Okay, well, next up I want to do a series of three stories on the topic of poverty. This first one is from the Food Politics blog, and it is a book review. So here's a summary of that. This is Marion Nestle's review of the book, The Painful Truth About Hunger in America, Why We Must Unlearn Everything We Think We Know and Start Again, by the author Mariana Chilton. Mariana Chilton's uncompromising book cuts to the heart of what's wrong with America's safety net for poverty and hunger. Her tough analysis derives from the lived experiences of people dependent on this system, despite its demonstrable inadequacies, inequities, and indignities. This is one tough book to read, as Chilton warns us right from the start. Accepting food and financial assistance is a deeply humiliating experience. Worse, it is intended to be so, right from the start. Chilton's work is highly unusual. She gains the trust of participants in the system by listening closely when they will tell her what it is really like for them and how they feel about it. This system is so bad and self-sustaining that nothing short of a complete overhaul can fix it. We must do better. The author says, poverty costs the United States at least $1 trillion a year. For every dollar spent on reducing childhood poverty, the country would save at least $7 in government spending to address the health and social problems that arise from poverty. To fix this, we need to spend more money to help people avoid poverty. We need to fix the tax code, wage structures, and many other policies that exclude and exploit people who are poor so the wealthy will stop profiting off them. Chilton recommends the universals: universal health care, universal basic income, universal school meals, and universal child care. Anything short of that keeps the current system in place. So this is another example where, you know, people, like especially conservatives, like to talk about, you know, run the government as a business. Well, if you were running our society as a business and you could invest a dollar and save $7, I suggest we would do that. But it seems that nobody likes talking about poverty, let alone even looking at it. Except perhaps here at Just for the Health of It. And next up, another topic that gets a little bit of attention, but should be actually a no-brainer for people that think about it. This from Medical Express. Poverty significantly increases risk of mental illness, says UN. Poverty makes people up to 3 times more likely to suffer from mental illnesses such as depression and anxiety compared to the wealthy, the United States said in a new report. Competitive, consumption-oriented modern life is a threat to mental health, said a study compiled by the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Olivier de Schutter. Entitled The Burnout Economy, Poverty and Mental Health, the report states that poverty causes mental health conditions, which in turn constitutes an obstacle to escape from poverty. Those on lower incomes are up to 3 times more likely to suffer from depression, anxiety, and other common mental illnesses than those with the highest incomes. It said more than 970 million people around the world, or 11% of the global population, suffer from some kind of mental illness. Of these, 280 million have depression, and 301 million suffer from anxiety. Every year, suicide claims the lives of around 700,000 people, and it is now the fourth leading cause of death among people aged 15 to 29 globally. In the countries of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, between a third and a half of all requests for disability payments stem from mental health issues, and among young adults, this proportion shoots up to 70%, the study says. Globally, mental health conditions cause losses of $1 trillion annually. The returns on investing in treating depression and anxiety would therefore be considerable, said the report. And of course, this article highlights the fact that social conditions rather than simply weird biochemical abnormalities in the brain, is a root cause for mental illness suffered by hundreds of millions worldwide. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my personal guarantee to you is if you listen to this show for a year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And should that turn out to not be the case, I will gladly refund triple your money. Okay, next up and last in our regular reporting, this from MedPage Today. Poor sleep mediates the link between poverty and pain. Associations found in previous studies between osteoarthritis knee pain severity and neighborhood disadvantage may be explained not by poverty itself, but by worsened sleep that comes from living under such conditions, researchers said. While the Area Deprivation Index scores did not correlate directly with pain severity, they did correlate significantly with sleep efficiency, which in turn correlated significantly with pain scores. Neighborhood features such as crime and the fear of it, noise, light pollution, and poor walkability likely underlie impaired sleep that previous studies have linked with chronic pain severity, the group observed in arthritis care and research. Future research should explore which environmental factors, such as safety or noise, are most salient for sleep and pain outcomes, the authors wrote. Another surprise was that against the researchers' expectations from earlier findings, pain catastrophizing, that is emotional perceptions of pain that exceed patient scoring of pain severity, wasn't significantly associated with either area deprivation index scores or self-assessed pain level. Countless studies have tied poverty, both at the individual and community level, to all manner of worsened health states. Chronic pain is among them. Knee, osteoarthritis, and back pain are perhaps the most common sources of chronic pain. And previous research has found that neighborhood disadvantage predicts both increased knee osteoarthritis prevalence and worsened pain from it. Neighborhood disadvantage has also been linked repeatedly with poor sleep. The current study didn't look at particular neighborhood factors that might affect sleep quality. Nonetheless, the authors noted that poor neighborhoods are usually characterized by high crime, nighttime noise from sirens, vehicular traffic and aircraft, and bright lighting. Neighborhood walkability is another salient factor to consider, given that greater physical activity is associated with improved sleep quality, they added. And low-grade housing may have issues with temperature control, water leaks, vermin, etc., that can disrupt sleep. And to make a link to the earlier story about poverty and mental illness, basically every mental illness, one of the factors that's present is sleep disruption. There you go. Both a cause and an effect. Okay, well that brings us to our last feature of the show, bonus articles. A carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 44 bonus articles, so let's get to it. To start with a few nutrition stories. First up, limiting sugar in infancy is tied to less diabetes and hypertension in adulthood. The UK rationing in World War II provides a natural experiment on sugar consumption. And interestingly, the amount that was people were limited to was very similar to what the modern recommended limits are. So it's a very good natural study. And you look over the decades and decades since the end of World War II, and you can follow how much diabetes and hypertension happens in adulthood. And sure enough, limiting sugar early in life helps out. Bonus article two. Upcoming updated U.S. dietary guidelines will leave the problem of ultra-processed foods largely unaddressed. This is largely because of a conservative approach to evidence. There's been some really high quality, a few super high quality studies that have shown how much of a problem ultra-processed foods are. But they did not consider it enough for them to really wade into it. And of course, there are a lot of lobbying issues by food manufacturers going on there with those folks that are on that committee. So it looks like ultra-processed foods will not be really addressed in the next set of U.S. dietary guidelines. Bonus article 3, new weight loss drugs cause greater muscle loss than regular dieting or normal aging. So while they're very good at reducing your weight, they actually have a higher proportion of fat or muscle loss for the amount of fat that you would lose compared to regular caloric restriction or dieting, or even during the normal process of aging, where people may thin out, lose muscle, and sometimes lose fat as well. Bonus article 4, stricter toxic chemical rules reduce Californians and everybody's exposures. So California is known for its much stricter standards on a lot of toxics. And this is proven effective in reducing Californians' levels in their bodies. And also it helps everybody, certainly in the nation and probably the world, because when California sets a rule, a lot of manufacturers meet that rule for the entire country rather than producing separate products and such or processes, for the rest of the country. Bonus article 5, PFAS levels decreasing in blood of residents after water cleanup. So this is another good news story that you can deal with PFAS levels. This included both getting rid of the source, an industrial source of PFAS, limiting that, and by filtering the water. And sure enough, PFAS levels go down. So with PFAS, we call them forever chemicals. In this article, I find it interesting, you were talking about at least one PFAS compound having a half-life of about a year, meaning that if you have a level in your blood of a certain amount, you'll have half as much a year later, then half the next year. So in other words, after 3 years, you'd have a half of a half of a half, or if you're good at math, an eighth of what you'd have after 3 years. But because PFAS is so common in our environment, we just keep getting exposed even though we can slowly get it out of our body. Bonus article 6, e-waste from AI computers set to grow exponentially if unaddressed. So of course AI is in an exponential phase, and unless we figure out a way to deal with the e-waste that AI computing involves, we are going to get a lot more e-waste, which is some of the most dangerous waste that we have, a lot of toxins. Bonus article 7, increasing use of wildfire suppressants, which contain toxic metals, raises health concerns. So this is always a concern, but of course with increasing wildfires, they're using more of these wildfire suppressants, and these toxic metals are getting thrown into the environment, which are bad for both the environment and human beings. Bonus article 8, new tactic of chemical deforestation in Brazil avoids satellite detection and monitoring. So we're figuring out new ways to destroy the Amazon and Brazilian basin there, and this chemical deforestation, as opposed to, say, burning, clearing the forest, that produces a lot of smoke, which can be detected by satellite. They avoid that by using the chemical deforestation. Nasty. And the next article kind of gets at why that might be even more of a problem. Bonus article 9, Bayer's new Roundup products, more toxic than prior formulations. So they've been litigating Roundup for decades, and finally Bayer is reformulating their products, but it turns out that they're even more toxic than the original one. Of course, this will unleash decades more of litigation, and so we go round and round as corporations avoid accountability. Bonus article 10, 38% of tree species worldwide face extinction threat, surpassing endangered animal species. So we often talk about animal species when we're talking about being endangered, but actually a higher proportion of tree species face extinction threat. Bonus article 11, biodiversity in protected areas is shrinking faster than in unprotected regions, partly because those are very sensitive areas. That's why they're trying to be protected. But I think the larger issue here, the thing that we can learn, is that you can't just isolate little things in the environment and not have it affected by the larger environment, the global environment, your national environment, the surrounding environment, just outside or even far away from these protected areas. We need to protect the whole planet. We can't just have little spots of the Garden of Eden or whatever, when the rest of the world is a toxic waste dump or something. Just doesn't work the way that's not the way ecology works. And this is why we have the One Health approach, where we recognize that human health is linked to animal and plant and natural conditions. Bonus article 12, UN biodiversity talks gridlocked and conservation funding falls far short. So they have a hard time agreeing on much of anything, but if you want the real measure, follow the money. funding is far, 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 far short from what they're saying is needed to make a transition to supporting increased biodiversity rather than decreasing biodiversity. Bonus article 13, climate change is making it harder for people to get the child care and health care they need. So the climate crisis is causing basic things in people's lives, like getting child care or health care, is being disruptive. So that's just a sign of the times. Bonus article 14, Ukraine's wartime environmental damage could lead to long-term ecological recovery by rewilding. This is a fascinating story because, of course, war is incredibly damaging, even to the environment. But if you destroy like dams, it actually leads to a rewilding effect where these dams actually reduce the biodiversity, for instance, in ecological systems around the dam. And also, when you have areas that are abandoned by people due to war, they're actually allowed to recover. So even even given the damage of the war itself, when people clear out of an area and large human infrastructure is destroyed, actually nature tends to do better. This reminds me of the story about Chernobyl, where you have like an 18-mile radius where people aren't allowed because there's so much radiation. Nature actually does really well, even in a toxic radiation zone, mostly because people are more toxic than radiation, apparently. Bonus article 15. Dengue spreads in Florida after hurricanes bring ideal mosquito conditions. So this is just another example where the climate crisis is causing infectious disease to rise, and we're seeing that move farther and farther north. Those tropical diseases are moving into the southern U.S., and those various infectious diseases are increasing their spread, various diseases, different diseases in different places throughout the country. Bonus article 16. First U.S. case of bird flu in a pig raises concerns over potential human threats. So pigs are particularly good crucibles for recombining viruses. And if you get co-infections in pigs of bird flu and other flu, then you can get combinations that can then can be transmitted to humans and can potentially start a bird flu pandemic. So there's a marker. Bonus article 17, tracking the U.S. bird flu outbreak has been hard. It's about to get harder with the normal seasonal rise in flu. So when you're looking for flu symptoms, bird flu symptoms are not that different from regular seasonal flu. So when you get this background of a lot of normal flu during flu season, then it's harder to figure out if it's actually bird flu and do testing. Bonus article 18. A bird flu vaccine might come too late to save us from H5N1, which is, of course, the bird flu that we've been talking about. This is largely because we have a very small national stockpile compared to the amount that would be needed if we had a quick outbreak, which is, of course, the way outbreaks work. You can have a matter from, oh, don't worry about it, to a few weeks, you have a worldwide global pandemic. Bonus article 19. Expert committee backs extra COVID vax dose for seniors and pneumococcal vaccine for adults 50 and up. So basically with the COVID vaccine, you get pretty decent protection, like 40% protection from for instance, death, the worst outcome. So that holds off pretty good, but it approaches near zero for preventing hospitalization after about 6 months. So basically they're saying for seniors, you know, go ahead and get a second shot, get one every 6 months, partly because COVID is more serious than the flu, and the vaccines wane. Of course, flu vaccines wane as well. The problem is flu season tends to happen in half a year, whereas COVID, you know, bounces around with different peaks throughout the year. It isn't nearly as seasonal. So therefore, recommending two doses for those higher at risk. And the pneumococcal vax used to be generally recommended for people 65 and up, but we're seeing that being more beneficial for younger age groups as we're seeing pneumonia rise in younger populations, particularly that like 50 to 65 group you see in the black population particularly affected. And it makes the recommendation a little simpler too by just doing 50 and up. Bonus article 20. An Idaho health department isn't allowed to give COVID-19 vaccines anymore. Experts say it's a first. So this is the first time that a local health department has banned COVID-19 vaccines from being given by the health department. So this is, I guess, a victory and perhaps an inflection point for the anti-vax movement. The medical director advised it, advised to continue being able to give COVID-19 vaccines, not unsurprisingly, but from a 4-3 vote from the board, they got rid of it. Bonus Article 21. Do no harm is hurting millions of long COVID patients as there is not a single FDA approved treatment yet, almost 5 years since the beginning of the COVID pandemic. So need to really get on that, not be so conservative and start doing even off-label uses of drugs to try to find things that will work for people with long COVID. Millions and millions of people affected by that in this country. Bonus Article 22, COVID-19 sharply boosts risk for blood fat disorders. This was an interesting study, and we've seen before signals of increased heart disease after COVID, but this one specifically sees blood fat disorders, which is like, you know, cholesterol, triglycerides, that type of thing, which are risk factors for heart disease. Bonus Article 23, McDonald's E. coli crisis reveals why vegetable contamination is a harder problem than beef itself, as cooking destroys many fecal contaminants. So, this is an interesting story, and I think they missed the real story here. So, E. coli is an indicator, comes from fecal matter. So, that contaminates the environment, and this is largely from concentrated animal feeding operations that just happen to be close by agriculture, say vegetables that are being grown. And the thing is, vegetables are not always heated to kill the fecal contaminants, whereas beef and other meat, it tends to be heated to a point where those contaminants are killed. So it ultimately comes from livestock production, but we get it through our vegetables because that's where the fecal contaminants end up. Bonus Article 24, drug overdose deaths are down 9% in 2023, putting Ohio at the 12th highest rate in the U.S. So we still rank very high at the rate of drug overdose deaths, but they are going down. Bonus Article 25, overdose deaths are rising among Black and Native Americans. So while this downward trend is being driven by whites, we're actually seeing increased overdose deaths among Blacks and Native Americans. Bonus Article 26, how to make sure opioid settlement money isn't wasted. There's a lot of evidence-based methods to use that money. A lot of them aren't being used. They're using unproven things that are just politically feasible or people's pet projects. Bonus Article 27, online gambling poses significant public health threat. So there's been a large increase in online gambling. Obviously, sports gambling is a big part of that, and that can be even just your, you know, through your phone or whatever. And this kind of addiction is increasingly causing problems. Bonus Article 28, Medicare hidden information hurts people and policy. If you've tried to ever figure out Medicare health plans, there's a lot of information that you, even if you had it, you probably couldn't sort through it, but you can't even get it. Just another complication with having dozens and dozens of Medicare Advantage plans to compare with traditional Medicare. Very confusing. Bonus Article 29, DACA dreamers are able to sign up for Obamacare for the first time. So this would be about, they estimate about 100,000 people will be able to buy health insurance on Obamacare exchanges. Bonus Article 30, why a doctor had to figure out a way to prescribe electricity. This is just a good example about the interface of medicine abutting up to social determinants of health. So people who need electricity, say, to run a particular device, like, you know, for oxygen or whatever, or just to be safe in their home, or to even have a refrigerator, for instance, if you want healthy, nutritious food, there's a lot of reasons why electricity is good for our health, and if you don't have it, it can be a problem. And this is an interesting story that gets into how even a hospital was actually producing electricity from solar panels and providing it to credits to different people who needed those credits on their electric bill. Bonus Article 31, dentists are pulling healthy and treatable teeth to profit from implants. Unfortunately, not all doctors are looking at social determinants to benefit poor individuals who can't afford electricity. Some are just taking the easy way of just pulling every tooth they can get a hold of just for profits. This is particularly nefarious because the implants are generally not as good as your actual teeth. There's problems with that, and a lot of the dentists that are pulling these teeth are not necessarily well-trained to put the implants as well. Bonus article 32. Doctors, to get your patients to share, stop judging them when they do. So in public health, non-judgment is a huge factor to make public health work. It's also true in medicine. If you want to get your patients to share, you have to be non-judgmental so that you can build that trust to know what actually is going on. Bonus article 33. Not medically necessary. Inside the company enabling America's biggest health insurers to deny coverage for care. So this company that covers that is working with insurers that cover one-third of people with private health insurance, it's one of these algorithms that really ticks up the amount of denials and care. And of course, that particular company gets paid by, you know, they get a cut of the money that they save by cutting care, even though it may be medically necessary. Bonus article 34. Iconic gun makers gave sensitive customer information without their consent to partisan political operatives. So this is something that happened quite a while ago, but they're just finding out about it. And probably for those Second Amenders who are really pro-gun and stuff, you may want to read this just to recognize that gun makers, like many other corporations, their financial and political interests don't necessarily align up with individuals. Bonus article 35. Former FDA lawyers join tobacco industry in epic fight against the agency. So this is just a story of the revolving door where people who may have even been involved in formulating or enforcing these regulations turn around and join industry in the fight against the agency. Bonus article 36. Tobacco companies may have found a way to make vapes more addictive to kids by displaying animations with each puff. Yep, go figure. The tobacco companies got to give them credit for being creative. Unfortunately, it's in direct proportion to how evil they are for public health. Bonus article 37. Drinking is cheaper than it's been in decades. Lobbyists are fighting to keep it that way. So a lot of these alcohol taxes and stuff, some have been decreased, but even just over the years with inflation and stuff, they haven't kept up, and lobbyists are fighting to keep it that way. Taxes on things like alcohol and tobacco have been shown to be some of the most effective ways to reduce drinking. And again, I'll remind you that the alcohol industry, if you were to pick a random drink that was taken, it is more likely than not that that drink is consumed in an abusive fashion, meaning more than four drinks at a time for a woman or five drinks at a time for a man. Bonus article 38. A look at the Supreme Court's upcoming term. Public health is on the chopping block once again. So if you want a review of that, unfortunately, the story here is that maintaining the status quo where we're at is perhaps the best scenario, as the Supreme Court is not friendly to public health. Bonus article 39. Black Americans still suffer worse health. Here's why there's so little progress. This is a good overview of why black folks are suffering great health disparities pretty much across the board. Bonus article 40, there's always some population that's worse. Will there be a future for newborns in Gaza? So with the genocide going on there, it's a terrible place for a pregnant woman or a newborn, but the larger question of what kind of future can there even be in Gaza is haunting. Bonus article 41, to get back to a first world problem, standing desks may be worse for your health than sitting. Moving regularly is the best option. So standing desks were, posed by a lot of people selling standing desks to be much better for your health than sitting. Sitting is not particularly good for you, but unfortunately with standing, this particularly good large study showed that it didn't seem to reduce like cardiovascular mortality, but you may actually get more varicose veins standing up than sitting down. But of course, the best option is move, move, move. So if you're sitting down a lot during the day, get up regularly and move around. Bonus article 42. Survey reveals half of U.S. teens stare at screens more than 4 hours per day. And a related story, bonus article 43. Is human contact in the digital age a scarce luxury good? So as making everything digital seems to be the force that seems to be ruling our lives at this time. This is cutting into face-to-face, in-person encounters, except for those that are very rich. So is human contact in the digital age a scarce luxury good? That is a sad commentary on modern society today. And last but not least, bonus article 44, most Americans say not enough being done to ensure affordable mental health care. And I put that one also just to accent that, you know, treating our mental health problems with an army of counselors, you know, can be helpful. But if we have problems with being able to make human contact and that kind of connection, which is fundamental for our mental health, or get a good night's sleep because we're poor or live with light pollution or noise pollution, it's going to be a long road to hoe. You can view these and other stories by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-